Okay, it's 1:50 now. Welcome, everybody. I think that most of you have gone to lunch just before the session, so I know it's tough. I'll try to keep it interesting. I want to make the most out of the session for you. We're going to be talking about Always On and SQL Server 2014. How many people have used Always On so far? Good. Good percentage of people. How many people are using it in production today? Very good. Okay. That's around 50-60% of the audience. So my name is Luis Vargas. I'm a program manager lead on the SQL Server team. So I work in Redmond as part of the SQL Server unit, and my team owns a few things. We own high availability for SQL Server. So we own things like Always On, but we still own things like database mirroring, for example, SQL clusters, and log shipping. So if you have used some of those technologies, those are things that we do in the team. And we also own additional new things that we're doing with Windows Azure or Microsoft Azure. We have renamed it recently, where now you can do things like backups to the cloud or disaster recovery into the cloud. So those are the other things that we do in the team. So it seems that most of you have used Always On to some extent. So I'm going to go quickly to this section. I was going to give a quick overview on what high availability solutions we have in 2012 for people who are not familiar with those, and then jump into what is new in SQL Server 2014. If anything is unclear, feel free to raise your hand, and I think there are some microphones there. I don't know what is the fastest way. Probably just if you're loud enough, just feel free to ask the question. I'll repeat it for the rest of the audience. I'll probably take a couple of questions, for each slide, and then we can leave maybe 10 minutes at the end if there are more questions. So looking back into SQL Server 2012, first thing is, at that point in time, we already had some high availability technologies. So we already had database mirroring for a couple of releases. We had SQL clusters for three or four releases already, and we had log shipping. So why did we want to introduce a new term? Well, the thing is, there were some opportunities in some of these areas where we could improve. So let me go quickly to the areas that we look as we started thinking about Always On. The first one is we wanted to have a single solution that was reliable and was able to stand multiple failures. So for example, today, or sorry, not today, but before SQL 12, if you wanted to have a high availability solution which also had disaster recovery, that meant that you have to combine multiple solutions, right? So you probably have SQL clusters locally, and then maybe you have database mirroring to a different data center, right? Or you may have database mirroring locally and maybe log shipping to a different data center. So those are different solutions that you have to manage and configure. So we wanted to have a single solution that could stand multiple failures, right? So you could have multiple replicas, for example, either in the same data center or across multiple data centers, and we could survive the failures of more than one replica, right? I talk about a single integrated solution, right? So with Always On, there is a single solution that you can go and manage, single security model. So all your users, for example, can be controlled with regards to how they can modify the Always On configuration, who can add replicas, who can do failovers and all those things, instead of having to configure this for, again, log shipping or database mirroring or SQL clusters. We know that high availability environments are expensive in terms of hardware, so you need to maintain these secondary replicas or secondary servers, right? And each of these costs, and in the end, you want to be able to make use of these servers, right? So you already have some CPU, some memory available, and most likely those secondary machines have the same characteristics as the primary, because in the case of failures, you need to be able to fail over and continue running. So we wanted you to be able to use this hardware for something else than just waiting for a failure to happen. And that's, we took the first step in SQL 2012, and we're working towards improving or enhancing the type of operations that you can do on those secondary servers. And finally, we wanted to ensure that after a failure, you can quickly recover, right? It's fundamental for any high availability solution that your applications can continue running as soon as there is a failure. So let's go back to the deck. Talking about Always On. So just making sure that everybody's on the same page. Always On is not really a specific solution or technology. Always on is the marketing term that we use now in SQL Server to refer to high availability technologies. I sometimes see in forums, for example, people arguing between is always on better than availability groups, for example, or always on better than cluster. In the end, always on refers to this umbrella of high availability solutions. And then we have two specific technologies under always on. So we have failover cluster instances. Again, this is the SQL clusters that traditionally you have been using in the past. And then we have the new solution called availability groups, right? So failover cluster instances, pre-existing solution available since SQL 2000 actually has been there for a while. It provides server failover. So the full server basically fails over to a different physical machine or virtual machine. Very useful in consolidation scenarios. So if you have hundreds of databases, or if you have a large number of dependencies that live outside of your user databases. So for example, if you have a large number of SSIS packages, agent jobs, link servers, things like that, and you want the full SQL server to fail over to a different instance, SQL clusters is a good solution for that. It requires shared storage, right? So how many people are using SANs today? Most of you? Go ahead. How many people think SANs are expensive? Okay. So yeah, so we support SANs. We support SMB chairs. The only thing to consider is with SQL clusters, the assumption is that the storage provides some level of redundancy, right? So if the storage goes down and it doesn't have any underlying redundancy, SQL clusters is not going to protect you from that. SQL cluster is basically protecting the SQL Server running service, right? That we can fail over to a different server. Failover takes between 30 seconds to a couple of minutes. In the past, I would have said just a couple of minutes. There were some investments in SQL 2012 to make these recovery times smaller. So failover times now can take around 30 seconds. And this takes some time because it requires restarting the SQL Server service in a different machine. And as part of that restart, we need to recover all of those databases in that server. So each of those databases has a log, right? And there are some transactions that have been committed but haven't been applied to the data pages that vice versa that didn't commit and then we need to roll back. So that recovery process needs to happen after the failover to the other machine. The SQL instance itself is the replica for the full SQL cluster. So one SQL instance basically maps to one replica in the SQL cluster. And you can have multiple nodes, but it's all passive, right? So depending on the version of Windows, I think with Windows 2012, we introduced 64 nodes. So all of those can be replicas for your SQL cluster, but in the end, all of those are passive. And passive means you cannot really use them for anything else besides high availability. We introduce availability groups, right? And this provides high availability for groups of databases. Again, the idea is the availability group ensures that multiple databases fail over together. So if your application, like your OLTP banking system, depends on three or four databases, right? All of those databases will have high availability together when you put them in the same availability group, right? And we'll fail them over together to a different server. It doesn't require a SAN. All it requires is having attached disks in each of the SQL Server instances. So it's, from that perspective, a much cheaper solution than having to depend on the SAN. And the way that we ensure that you have all these different copies of the databases is through log synchronization. And log synchronization is basically we have a set of threads, right, on the primary, and then a set of threads on the secondary. And then every time that there is a transaction on the primary, we take the log records associated with those transactions, right, from the log, and then send them over the network to the secondary replica. And then in an asynchronous process, when the secondary replica receives those records, it applies them, right? So it takes the log and then applies those to the physical data pages. And that's when those changes become visible on the secondaries. Because these secondaries are pretty much standby hot servers, like they're receiving all these pages continuously, failover is pretty fast. So failover, I say less than 30 seconds. I know, for example, in some of our customer deployments who have spent a lot of time optimizing the system, this can go up to like 8-9 seconds for a failover, so pretty fast failover times. And again, basically from the SQL perspective, all we have to do is at failover time, we mark the previous primary as offline, I would say you're not the primary anymore, and then a new primary we market as online, and then we start accepting connections, right, from the client perspective. So it's pretty fast. Every SQL instance can host many replicas, right? So let's say you have 100 databases, you can divide those across the different applications that you have, and then you say, I can have 20 or 30 availability groups, right? And each of those availability groups can have different secondary replicas in different servers. So you can amortize the cost, right, for these replicas across the same set of physical machines or virtual machines in case of a virtualized environment. And then these replicas are active in the sense that you can start moving some of those read workloads, for example, into those secondaries. Today, we still do not support moving write workloads. That's something that we're looking into right now. If you have some reporting workloads, for example, or BI workloads, you can move those already. You can also move backups as well. All right, so SQL clusters. Just very quickly, 2012, just a reminder of the things that we did. The first thing, multi-site clusters. How many people are using multi-site clusters across different data centers? Just a couple of you. Okay, got it. So the idea with multi-site clusters is really simplify the cluster configuration across data centers, right? So in the past, you basically had to stretch a virtual LAN that will cover your disaster recovery site, right? And then all of those machines will become visible through the virtual LAN. We have simplified that solution, so now you can do these clusters across subnets, which basically maps to different data centers without the need to do that. I'm not going to spend a lot of time here. If you search for each of these names in books online, you'll get all the information about how to configure them. Right? TempDB on local disks, so we allow you now to store, you know, your temporary databases on the local disk of the machine so that you don't have to store them in the expensive SAN. It's also better for performance, right? So you have some SSD drives, for example, attached to the machine. You can put TempDB there and just use the SAN for your databases. Indirect checkpoints. So again, this is a new feature that allows you to specify how much recovery time you want to allow in case of a failover. And the way it works is we basically, you can specify how often to write dirty pages to the disk, right? And dirty pages are pages that have changed in memory but haven't been applied to disk. Those are pages that at recovery time will have to be applied. So if you reduce the checkpoint timing, and basically we're checkpointing more frequently, on one hand, there is more CPU and IO utilization. But on the other hand, at recovery time, there is less work to do, so your failover time will be smaller. So something else to look at if today you're running into high failover times with SQL clusters. And finally, flexible failover policies. So we allow you to specify multiple levels of failure that will cause automatic failover. So in the past, we had basically a single failure level, which was the SQL service is down. So if we detected that the service was down, we will cause a failover. And now you have multiple failures. It goes from 1 to 5, where 5, for example, includes things like out-of-memory exceptions. You know, you're continually running out of memory in the server, or unresolved deadlocks. If there are some deadlocks that we can't resolve under some timeout, then we can do a failover at that point in time. So depending on how critical your application is and how much sensitivity you want to have for failures, you can specify the failover mode. Again, availability groups. This is a solution that we introduced in SQL 2012. Couple of things important to call out. Multiple databases, again, in the same availability group. Multiple secondaries. In SQL 2012, we support 4 secondaries. Out of curiosity, how many people are using a single secondary today for availability groups? Just a couple. 2 secondaries? More, okay. And 3 secondaries? Couple people only. Okay, good. So we allow 4 secondaries. The maximum number of synchronous secondaries is 2. Again, synchronous means transactions on the primary block until the log records associated to those transactions are stored safely by the secondaries. And this is to avoid any data loss in the system, right? Compression and encryption. So all the data, all the log that we send between primary and secondaries is compressed. It is encrypted, so we make good use of the network bandwidth. It is secure, especially important between different data centers. We support manual and automatic failover. So if you patch the system, you do a manual failover. And for failures in your hardware, network or disk, for example, you can have automatic failover. Same thing as with cluster, we support flexible failover policies and automatic page repair. So automatic page repair is one of those features that we don't talk too much about it. The idea is if one of the replicas detects that some of the pages are faulty, and faulty means there is some corrupted, for example, there is some corruption on the page, that replica will request all the other replicas in the availability group for a healthy version, right, like a good version of the page. And then as soon as one replica receives the request, it will reply back with that page, and then we'll automatically replace it. So basically, this saves headaches in case of corruption, right? These are things that the system is doing to auto-self heal so that you don't have to, you know, worry about it. Quickly, people using things like System Center, for example, we totally support it, so you can control availability groups across SQL servers with System Centers. Application connectivity, so you probably know that we have something called the listener, right? People familiar with listeners, right? Good. So just a DNS name, this is what your clients connect to, right? And that DNS name maps to the primary replica. So that's how clients can connect to the replica, irrespective of how many replicas you have or whether they are in the same data center or different data centers. And then we support all the different features in SQL. So if you're using things like contained databases, which you probably should look at if you haven't looked yet, because then you can contain your user and passwords inside of the same database. So if your database fails over, your users and passwords move with that without the need for logins in the master database, so something to look at. File stream, file table, service broker, all of those features are supported. And we talk about support for reads and backups on the secondaries. Anybody using readable secondaries today for reporting, right? Some people, okay. And backups as well. PowerShell in case that you use it. Any questions on the background before we jump into 2014? Yes. The readable secondary? It can be used. There are some, there are a couple of things. There are a couple of SharePoint databases, for example, that they do not recommend it. I think system databases, for example, or the things that SharePoint considers as system databases, they don't recommend them. But user databases, they're supported. Any other questions? Yeah. Absolutely. The question is, can you read from the readable secondaries without creating a snapshot? Yes. And that's really the main value proposition. So unlike mirroring before where you have to create a snapshot and maintain the snapshot, you don't have to do that. The secondaries accept connections. I'll actually show you all this in a demo in a second. You can read from them. Yeah.
On the backups, is that for like forward transaction where you do all your backups in the secondary?
Yes. So about the backups, like what kind of backups we support. So today in your backup strategy, very likely you're doing full backups every, you know, couple of days, and or maybe every week, I don't know, differential backups every couple of days, and log backups maybe every half an hour, 50 minutes. So you can start moving some of those backups into these secondary replicas. So backups are IO intensive operations. Basically, SQL uses as much IO as it can to complete the backup as soon as possible. So you probably want to move that to the secondaries. Today, there are two types of backups that we support. We support full backups, right? But you need to specify an option called copy only. And that basically means we don't map the differential flag in the log. So the only consideration from your side is differential backups, unfortunately today, are not supported on the secondary replicas, right? We support full backups, we support log backups. So what we recommend is if you need differential backups, you still need to take your full backups and differential backups on the primary replica, but your log backups can be in the secondary replicas. If you're not using differential backups today, then feel free to use full backups, copy-only backups on the secondaries together with the log backups, right? Any other questions? All right, and this is just how an availability group deployment looks like. We have many customers like you using similar configurations. So on one hand, you have your main data center, right? and then you have a couple of SQL servers. Each of those servers has databases, and then you can add those to an availability group, right? In this case, we call it A, and you have your primary, and then you have your secondary, and you configure this for synchronous replication with automatic failover, right? And then in different data centers, you can add one or more secondaries, right, which you configure as asynchronous secondaries, right, to avoid any transaction latency impact on your primary, and you configure them for manual failover. Most people do this. There are a couple of customers that have data centers that are very close together. You know, they have very low latency, less than 20 millisecond round trip, for example, and they can configure this secondary as automatic failover, right? In most cases, disaster recovery is a manual decision. You want to know, you want to decide when to do it. So most people actually configure this as manual. And then if there are some parts of the organization, for example, that are far and you want to run some reporting workloads, like if there are some clients here that want to do some reporting on those databases, you could have a secondary replica of your availability group available for that, right? Many customers today take backups on the secondary outside of the data center for compliance reasons. So it's important to maintain these backups in case of oops recovery, right? Someone deletes a table, for example. If you have the really bad luck that at the same time your local backups are unavailable, then you could always recover them from the backups on the other data center. All right, so let's jump into 2014. So here's the list of investments, and we're gonna go through each of these, and we're gonna see demos for all of these things. So the first one, for availability groups, we have increased the number of secondaries. Again, seems like a trivial change. Pretty much trivial to do the change. It's a little bit more work to ensure that adding more secondaries doesn't impact the performance of the primary, right? So we'll talk about that. Increased availability of readable secondaries. So we'll talk about, you know, why we did it and why this is important for people using readable secondaries today. And finally, we'll talk about disaster recovery into Windows Azure, right? So were any of you this morning in the foundational session where they were showing the replica in the cloud? Anybody? Some people? Okay. So we'll look into that a little bit. For SQL clusters, we have support for a new, very exciting feature. It's cluster share volumes. That's coming from Windows. So we'll talk about why that is important to you and how you can use it. And finally, we have done a lot of work just improving our diagnostics infrastructure, right? Making sure that you have all the right solutions in case there is a failure so that you can troubleshoot the system. All right, so let's go through each of these. Increased number of secondaries. Again, why this is important. So today, many of you are using these readable secondaries to run, for example, reporting workloads. The main reason is you have a single solution to configure and manage. So some of you in the past may have been using transactional replication. How many? Okay. So transactional replication is a great solution for scaling out reads, right? It allows you to have multiple subscribers of your databases. It allows you different schemas. You can create indexes, for example, on those subscribers to map your read workloads, and it works pretty well. However, there are some scenarios where you don't require, for example, to go and have different schemas between publisher and subscriber, and the cost of having to go and configure replication and manage replication, which is not a trivial solution, is not worth it. So some of our customers have told us that if they already have this optional readable secondaries with availability groups, they would like to be able to just use it and, you know, replace transactional replication in some scenarios. The other reason is availability groups is a lot faster in terms of how many transactions we can push per second from the primary to the secondary as compared to replication. Just a rough number is about seven times, right? There are different reasons why. Transactional replication uses logical replication, where basically we are redoing a bunch of statements on the other side. In the case of availability groups, we're just physically sending the log and applying it there. So it's a lot faster. Anyway, so what we have heard from many customers is they would like to have additional replicas for a couple of reasons. The main one is many corporations are increasing in terms of size. They have offices across different parts, for example, of the US or different parts of Europe. And they would like to be able to maintain a local copy in each of those offices, right? So that reporting workloads, for example, can run locally without having to go all the way to the primary, right? So you want to avoid the cost of, you know, running all of these workloads on the primary plus the latency cost in the network. And the other reason is there is a few customers that would like to be able to scale out even beyond the four secondaries that we have today. So there are some reporting workloads, for example, that require a lot of CPU, and they would like to be able to expand it. So we have increased the number from four. We have eight now. Again, the maximum number of synchronous secondaries is still two, and this is to avoid any data loss in the system. So for high availability, you still have your two secondaries, but for reporting, you can go all the way to six asynchronous secondaries. Right? How much delay the secondaries have depends on the network latency. Right? So depending on the network latency plus how fast the disks are on the secondary replica, this can take between one second in the same data center to around 5 seconds between different data centers. Something that is important, if you go and increase the number of secondaries, maybe not today, maybe you know in a couple of years, the performance impact to your primary workload is really, really small. It's less than 1%. So if today you start without any secondaries, right, and then in 2 years you add 8 asynchronous secondaries, again, the performance impact is less than 1%. So you know you have the option to go and scale out over time. Something that we didn't have time to do as part of this release is automatic load balancing in the connection string. This is something that we're working on for the next release. And what this means is if you want to load balance, for example, across the secondaries, what you can do is use DNS. So you can simply create multiple DNS entries, right, with the same name, and then you assign the IPs of these readable secondaries, and then you get load balancing like that through round robin. Or you can use any load balancers that you have today available, like a network load balancer, for example. All right. Probably this is the least exciting of the demos. Well, actually, this is not a demo, just a set of screens. But what this shows is you'll have all the same manageability that you have today, just with increased number of secondaries. So this is a demo of just showing how many replicas you can add to the availability group, right? And after that, basically the wizard that we have today will complete running all of those configurations. So irrespective of how many secondaries you add, the same functionality applies. In Object Explorer, similar to before, you have all the list of replicas. You can quickly go through one of these replicas and change all the configurations. So you just right-click on the availability group, and you can change the configuration of these replicas, right? So you can change between the synchronization mode, right? Synchronous versus asynchronous, the failover mode, automatic versus failover versus manual, and then what type of connections you want to allow on the primary, and if it's readable or not, right? So just by changing that, very quickly you can have as many as 8 readable secondaries in the system. The same dashboard that we have today that you have been using to manage the system still works exactly the same. Now it's more useful to have this lower part where you can group by all your databases in different ways. So you can group by, for example, and look at which of the databases are synchronized, which are synchronizing, and then you can look and compare each of those. You know, when was the last time that they committed a transaction? What was the last transaction that they committed? And you can compare this versus the primary replica, right? So it's useful to have the same manageability for all of this. Any questions with that? Does that make sense? All right. So let's talk about increasing the availability of readable secondaries. So in SQL 2012, there are some situations where your read workload may be killed during some network failures. The main situation is if you have a geo-distributed environment, so imagine you have the primary data center in New York, and then you have your secondary data center all the other way in Seattle, for example. In some of these scenarios, network failures are more common than you would like, right? Like your ISP provider, for example, may have failures from time to time. And if that causes a disconnection between the primary replica and the secondary replica, any read workloads that are running on the secondary replica are going to be killed at that point in time. And that is basically the way that the behavior was defined in SQL 2012. Now, some of our customers would like to have those read workloads running, you know, at all times, irrespective of what happens in the network. Your ISP, for example, for some reason may have a problem that lasts a few hours. You don't want to even know about that in your on your disaster recovery side. If you have multiple offices, for example, that are depending on reading from those secondaries and running some BI workloads or some reporting workloads, you don't want to have them impacted by failures in the network. So we have changed that behavior in SQL 2014 so that readable secondaries will not be impacted by any failures in the network, right? Similarly, if for some reason your primary replica goes down, the readable secondaries will not even, you know, your read workloads will not even be impacted by that, or similar to cluster quorum loss. So in scenarios where, for today, for example, your cluster is running out of quorum because you lose connectivity between the nodes, again, this will not impact your read workloads. So if you're familiar with the states of these replicas, if the secondary loses connection to the primary, it goes into something called the resolving state. And the resolving state basically means I don't know who the primary is at this point because I cannot connect to the primary. So even in that state, your read workloads will continue running, right? And if you have new connections that try to connect to the replica in resolving state, we'll still allow the connections and you can continue running. Today, this requires direct connections to the readable secondaries. So if you're using read-only routing, anybody, read-only routing today? Just some people, okay. So read-only routing allows you to specify in the connection string that you are a readable secondary so that SQL Server will automatically route you to the first readable secondary in the system, right? However, that today that mechanism works by going to the primary first, getting the list of readable secondaries, and then routing the connection to one of those secondaries. Obviously, if your primary replica is down, read-only routing won't be able to find the primary. So if you have a read workload that you want to continue running at all times, even if the primary goes down or the network to the primary goes down, then you have to connect directly to the readable secondary, which in most cases is what customers do today because in different data centers, for example, they can affinitize all those connections, right, and have all those applications running against the local secondary. Right? That makes sense? Yes? That's a good question. So if you lose your connection between your primary and one of the replicas, what happens to the log? So today, the log will continue growing, right? So, and the reason is we need to guarantee that you don't lose any data, right? So the log basically will truncate only when all of those secondaries have received the log. The recommendation is if what you can do is if you lose connectivity for more than a couple of hours, for example, you can pretty much automate just removing that replica from the availability group, and then you can re-add it once you have connectivity again. So you can do that through T-SQL or PowerShell. Right? Again, all of this is to protect, you know, and avoiding data loss. Something that we're looking at into the future is maintaining those transactions, but outside of the log, right? So that we can still truncate the log, but we can maintain it in a different place. So something that we're looking into. Any other questions? All right, so this is just showing what I was describing. So the same deployment as before. If your main data center loses connectivity, right, between your two disaster recovery sites or the data center goes down, your reporting workloads will continue running. So let's look at a demo for all of this. Let's look at the demo first, and then we'll talk about Stack Overflow. All right, so what I have here is one availability group. It's running on SQL Server 2014. So we can look at the availability group on the left. I have three replicas, right? I'm connecting to the primary, HADR0. I have a couple more secondaries. I'm protecting one database, foo, right? I have the dashboard here. It's telling me that the availability group is healthy. This healthy is just a roll-up of the health of all the replicas, right? If all the replicas are healthy, then the availability group is healthy. So you can see the replicas are healthy. These are configured as synchronous replicas. And I have two for automatic failover, right? And then I have one more for manual failover. And then I have the database here. I have all the copies of the database, right? So each of these replicas has its own copy. All of them are synchronized. This is the last transaction sequence number in the log that I committed. And this is the last time that they committed the transaction, right? And this is basically how far behind the secondary is. So this is the number of seconds that your secondary is behind compared to your primary. All right, so at this point, let me connect to, the primary. So I'm currently connecting to the primary. Let's use the database. All right, so I'm going to insert a few values here, just three values, nothing exciting. Right? We can go to the readable secondary. So I'm going to go to HADR1. Right? That's my readable secondary. I connect here. Let me add my name here. So I can go to the readable secondary here. And then just let's read some values. I was going to do this one. Let me read them from the other readable secondary. So let's read some values here. So I just have the values, right? Nothing exciting. You can use this secondary for your reporting workloads. This is the same behavior as we have in 2012. At this point, let's start doing some crazy stuff. Let's stop the primary, for example. Right? I'm going to stop my primary replica. Right? So the SQL Server service is going to go down at this point. And then what is going to happen is my secondary configured for automatic failover is going to become my new primary. Right? So we detect the failure, and we continue running on the other one. So at this point, this one is down. So I go to this one. Now this one is the primary. Right? There was a failover. I continue running my OLTP workloads, no issues. I can go to my readable secondary and continue running, you know, my read workloads. All of this is already available in 2012, right? We haven't shown anything new yet. Now, let's show the new stuff. So the new stuff is, if I go now to my new primary, right, and then I stop it, so if I stop it at this point, I won't have any primaries. Right? So my two primaries are down. I don't have any other primary available for automatic failover. So at this point, my OLTP workloads will not be running. This is where DBAs become, you know, pretty excited, and they are called, right? And hopefully they can fix all these issues before calling Microsoft support. Okay, but at this point, in SQL 2012, if I had to read this, basically, it will tell me, you can't, the replica is in the recovery stage. Not recovery, sorry, in the, in the resolving state. This is the state that we have here. Right, so you can see, this is telling me the replica is in the resolving state. And this is because there is no primary available at this point in the system. But if I go and read, just continues reading. So your read workloads will not even notice the fact that you don't have primaries or you lose connectivity to the other data center. They just continue running. That's a pretty, pretty powerful statement there. At this point, you probably are wondering, like, how do I know that there is something bad in the system? So the first thing is here, Object Explorer shows you that. If you go into the dashboard, it will show you, like, I think enough crosses that you'll notice that there is something wrong. So there is, like, a cross here, resolving, critical, resolving, bad, end of the world, right? So you can actually, like, choose, like the warnings, and it says the data synchronization state is not healthy, blah, blah. You click on this one, and it will tell you availability replica is disconnected. So you have a lot of indications here. If you want to do this programmatically, you have all the status here. So I can look at the status of that copy of the database and show you it's not synchronizing. However, the state of the database is online. You can continue using it. And this was the last time that it committed a transaction, right? So you can always evaluate this compared to the primary. And this was the actual log sequence number for the last transaction that was committed in the log. And you can compare this with the primary. So you know how many transactions, how much time this secondary is behind. At this point, I can go back to my new primary. You know, my DBA has finally understood the issue. There was a problem with connectivity of some sort. It has fixed the issue. It restarts the service. So this becomes my new primary. I can, at this point, go and insert some values. Right, so I'll just insert now three more values. I can go back to my readable secondary, and then at some point it will get them. Takes a little bit of time to catch up. Okay, demo worked. Okay, so it's like 3 seconds. What's going on? Normally it takes like less than a second. Anyway, so it sees the values. I can go back to the database replica. I can see that the last commit time has increased, the last commit sequence number has increased. And I can see that the replica is now connected and is healthy, right? So it has all the information. At some point, the dashboard, yeah, should show that everything is fine, so you don't see all the crosses anymore. I think, is that it? Let me see if there is anything else I want to show. I think we could insert more and more records, but you get the idea, right, at this point. So let's go back to the demo, sorry, to the presentation. So just talking about customers and why this is important. So anybody familiar with StackOverflow.com? Stack Overflow, yeah. People asking questions about software development, DBA, administration, all that. Okay. So Stack Overflow, they have been a SQL user for a long time. They started using availability groups in 2012. This is how the behavior looks like. So on the right side, they have the main data center running in New York, right? They have a couple of servers, SQL 1, SQL 2. These are configured for automatic failover. In Oregon, they have the disaster recovery site, right? And they have a replica there for configured as asynchronous with with manual failover. So information about the network. They actually share the specs. Like Stack Overflow are very open about sharing all the hardware configurations. So if you just search online for Stack Overflow, always on, you will see all the specs, and they're very open about all of these things. So this is the behavior. And after this change that we did, they can do things that they couldn't do before. So Stack Overflow is mainly a read site. Like most people go there to find answers to questions, right? So it's 80% reads. So what they can do now is, even if the main data center is down, all they have to do is change their DNS, point to the disaster recovery site, and they have 80% of the workload is still available, right? All of those reads can still continue running. They don't even need to do a failover. They simply modify the DNS. The websites continue running. Just some statement from the DBA from Stack Overflow. The increased readable second availability means that the user can still find answers, and their world keeps spinning. Right, so just one example of how this becomes useful. All right, let's talk about Azure and why it's important. How many of you have disaster recovery sites? Wow, okay, that's good. A lot of you, that's great. All right, many of our customers today can't afford a disaster recovery site. The disaster recovery site has cost in terms of, you know, you have a site that you need to pay rent for. There is some maintenance associated with the site. There is some hardware, and you need to have some operations team running the site. So for all of these customers, we wanted to provide a solution that they could use for disaster recovery, which was substantially cheaper than the disaster recovery site. So starting in SQL 2012, we started supporting adding replicas in Microsoft Azure. So this was around a year ago. Again, this is Microsoft Azure virtual machines. So this is not what you know as SQL Azure. This is the infrastructure as a service offering, where you can have virtual machines running in the Microsoft cloud. So we started supporting this around a year ago. What we have today is many customers that are running those replicas in Azure, not only for disaster recovery, but also for reporting workloads, for example, or for backups, right? They want to maintain backups outside of the main data center, and they can use this. We have many regions available around the world where you can add these replicas. So we have a couple of regions in the US, three regions in the US, a couple more in Europe, a couple in Asia. We have new regions coming all the time. Like we had one in Brazil that light up recently. So you can put all of those secondary replicas in the region that you prefer, right? How do you decide? It's going to be a combination of latency, right? You want to keep latency probably within 60, 70 milliseconds round trip, just to ensure that those secondary replicas are being able to catch up with the primary. Some of you may have some political considerations, for example, where data shouldn't allow or shouldn't be going out of Europe, for example. So depending on your considerations, you can decide where to put these replicas. The way this looks like is you have your main data center, right, and you have your primary and one or more secondaries for high availability. And now you can start adding one or more secondary replicas outside of your data center into Windows Azure, right? And those replicas behave exactly the same as how they behave on your on-premise environments, right? Any questions so far? Okay. So let's look into, so we talk about this. In case you want to see some of the customers that are doing this today, every time that there is some sort of new scenario where you start mixing new things, I know many of you want to see how, you know, what other customers are doing, how are they doing it, why is it good for them. So if you go into Microsoft Case Studies and search for those names, you will see some examples, for example, Lufthansa and GameStop and Thomson Reuters, et cetera, of how they're using these replicas in Windows Azure. Now, as I mentioned before, you can do this even today with SQL 2012, right? And we have all the documentation in books online on how to do it. In SQL 2014, we wanted to go one step forward and really try to simplify it for you. So we actually introduced a new wizard, right? This is a management studio wizard that allows you to add these replicas in the cloud end-to-end, right? So today, when you configure Always On, you know all the steps that you have to do. So you need to first have a machine that is available, and then you have to configure Windows Cluster, right? You need to add the machine to the Windows Cluster, and then you need to enable Always On, and then you need to take a backup and restore it, and then you need to start synchronization. So all of these are things that this wizard will do for you. It will validate the environment to make sure that, you know, at the end of the wizard, you have success. And also, if there is any failure, for example, because you lose connectivity to Azure, it will have some retry logic, right? So it will retry multiple times, and there is some timeouts and that you will take into consideration for that. So let me give you a quick demo of this one. So let me, I need to restart my primary. I was connecting to my primary, and it is down from the previous demo. So let me restart the primary. At some point, it will come back on this side. So what I have here is, again, SQL 2014. I have Management Studio. This is connecting to the same availability group that we were using before. Okay. At some point, it should come back. All right, so I have my availability group here. It has two replicas, primary and secondary. So let's say at this point, I want to have another replica available for disaster recovery, right? And I want to have it outside of my main data center. So what I can do is right-click in the availability group, same as before. We have this add replica functionality. You have used it probably, right? So you can click add replica, right? And then this will bring the same familiar experience that you have today in the wizard, where it will guide you through adding the replica. The first thing that I do is I connect to my existing secondaries, and this is because the wizard will need to configure the endpoints, which is basically the connectivity between the replicas, so it will have to configure permissions between all my replicas on-premise and that replica in the cloud, so that in case that I fail over to the cloud and that becomes my new primary, the other replicas can connect to it. So just connect to this one. I connect here, then sure that this is running. Yeah. It's taking a little bit of time. So I connect to the replica, and after that, I have the same experience that I had before. So I can specify what replica I want to add. This is the same button that we had before, right? The same one that you used to add the replicas in the past. So you can continue using this for local replicas. And now we have this new button called Add Azure Replica. And this will allow you to add these replicas in the cloud end to end. So when I click this button, it brings this screen, which is very similar to the screen that we have today in Windows Azure for configuring virtual machines. So if I go to the Windows Azure portal, right, and then I say, I want a new virtual machine, right, you see this is very, very similar. It will ask me what type of image I want to use to create that virtual machine. So we have different images. These images come with some version of Windows, some version of SQL, right? For example, I have Windows SQL Server 2012 here. Actually, we have many more images available. So you go to SQL Server, you see we have SQL Server 2014, for example, running on Windows Server 2012 R2 or Windows Server 2012, et cetera. Anyway, the idea is you have the same experience that you have in the portal, but now just from Management Studio. So you don't even have to go to the portal. I already have some certificate that I can use to manage a subscription. If you do this for the first time, you can say, download the certificate. It will ask you for your Microsoft Azure ID. You specify that, and it will automatically create a certificate, download it into your client, install it, and then you can use a certificate to manage your Windows Azure subscription. I say connect at this point. This will connect to my Windows Azure subscription, and it will automatically populate a bunch of these data fields for me. I can select the images that I want. These are the images that Microsoft provides. You can see I have a lot of images with very long names. These are images that I use in my demos, and I should use shorter names than that. Anyway, so you can specify, for example, 2014 RTM Enterprise on Windows 2012 R2, which is what I'm running here. You can specify the size of that virtual machine. So you can say I want a virtual machine with 4 cores or 8 gigabytes of RAM, or 8 cores and 14 gigabytes of RAM. We just introduced last week in some of the regions virtual machines with more RAM and more cores. So now we have 16 cores and 56 gigabytes of RAM available. So for now, I'm going to use just a large one. And then same as you will go and do it in the Microsoft portal, you can give a name to the virtual machine. So I can say, my virtual machine in Azure, and then just give it a name. I specify the administrator of that machine, some password. This is a virtual network. This is a configuration that has to be set up in advance. And the reason why we didn't go and do it is because this requires configuring network access between your on-premise environment and Windows Azure. So what this requires is basically configuring a VPN tunnel, right, between your data center and Windows Azure. And you can do this either on your physical router, like if you have some Cisco router, for example, you can do it there, or your network administrator can do it there. If you don't have that, you can do it through Windows Server, just using Server VPN. In Windows Server 2012, we have something called Routing and Remote Access Services, so you can actually create that tunnel there. On Thursday, I'm actually giving a session for high availability and disaster recovery involving Windows Azure. And as part of that, I'll show you more details on the tunnel and how to configure that. But at this point, I'm going to choose just one tunnel that I have, and I'm going to give it a password for my domain administrator. Sorry, not administrator, my domain account. I don't want to scare you. This is any domain account. You just specify a password here, and this is because I'll use this account to add that virtual machine in Windows Azure to my on-premise environment, right? So that I can use it as if it was any other replica in the system. At this point, I see that I have the replica here, right? It's a secondary replica. And you can configure it as readable if you want. All I have to say is, I want it to be readable, and that's it. You specify a location to share the backup. So we need to move your database from on-premise into the cloud the first time. So the way we do it is through a full backup, right? Depending, obviously, on the size of the database, it will take little or a lot of time. If it's a really, really, really large database, Windows Azure supports something called import service, where you can actually send your physical drive to UPS, and they will receive your database, and they will put it into Azure, and at that point, you can use it. Yeah?
What do you consider a very large database?
A very large database. I will say anything larger than a couple of terabytes. Yeah, I mean, if it's less than a couple of terabytes, you can probably leave it over the weekend. You know, you come back on Monday, and you'll have a copy running. But more than that, it'll probably take you a long time. OK, so I just specify that. And then the wizard will do a bunch of validations here. Not going to go into detail here. It's just, you know, making sure that everything will be working by the time that you execute the wizard. I don't think that there is anything exciting to show here. When I execute the wizard, basically the wizard will do everything for me, from provisioning the virtual machine to starting synchronizing transactions at the end of it. So I'm going to go back to the presentation. Running the wizard takes around 15 minutes, and this is because provisioning a virtual machine today takes around 10 minutes, right? So after that, it's depending on the size of the database. Any questions so far? So this finishes, and basically you can say, it will show you all the configuration that you defined here. So you say, this is the availability group. This is the name of the virtual machine that you're going to provision. This is the version of SQL and Windows, where you're going to provision it, the size of the virtual machine, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? And you can click Finish, and this will guide you through the full experience. And again, this is going to take around 15 minutes, right? So I'm not going to wait. Let's go back to the presentation. All right, enhanced diagnostics. So very important for DBAs. I know this is not very exciting sometimes, but let me just give you an insight into the type of things that we have done in SQL 14. So we have done 24 enhancements on multiple areas. The dashboard, right, the graphical UI that I show you, error messages, DMBs, X events. Anybody using X events today to monitor systems? Okay, X events is a great way of monitoring the runtime state of the system or going back in time and understanding what happened. So we have made a lot of investments on these areas. So here's just a small list of all the type of investments that we have done. Just giving you a couple of my favorite ones. The first one is we show UTC timestamps on the X event session. So people who have used X events, they know that today the only timestamp that we use is the local timestamp or the machine that opens the X event session. This is not super useful if you have machines across different geographic regions where you have different time zones. So now we show UTC so that you can have the same times across multiple replicas in a distributed environment. Many of you have asked about this. This is very simple but very useful. We have now a single function to find out who the primary replica is for a database, so you don't have to write a query across DMBs. We have dumped the output of HDR database replica states to the log. This is the DMB that gives you information about when was the last time that a replica committed, and when was the last transaction sequence number. And the reason why we put it in the log is because there are so many scenarios where you may not even have access to the DMBs, and you just want to have access. You want to know when was the last time that replica committed. So we also copied that information out into the log so that you have it available there as well. This is one of my favorite ones. Today, we have this error message, 41142. For some reason, replica can't become primary. And today, we raised the same error in 2012 for two reasons. We say it can be either because the secondary was not synchronized to the primary, or because the Windows cluster was started in force quorum mode. So you need to go and figure out which of the two exactly was the reason. So we have separated that into two error messages, right? And there are many more things that we have done. So again, the full idea of really simplifying troubleshooting the configuration. So let's quickly just show you a couple of these. The first one is showing who the primary replica is. Very simple, we have this new function. HADR is primary replica. You give it the name of the database. It returns whether the SQL instance is the primary for that availability group or not. If you run it in a different one, I don't have it here. Yeah, let me just copy it here. Let's copy it and just run it in the same one. So we can run this on another replica. Right, so this returns zero. So basically zero is not the primary, one is the primary. If you return it, you provided some database that doesn't exist, it just returns null, right? So that's basically how it works. I talk about the X event session. If you're not using it today, please start using it. It's very useful to understand what happened. Sometimes you wonder why something failover or didn't failover, and you wonder if someone modified the configuration or really some failure happened. First place to go, the X event session. So for example here, I can go to my X event session and I can see that a few days before, someone modified my availability group and they changed the failover mode to automatic, right, from manual. If someone modified this from automatic to manual, I will have similar errors. If there is an error in the system and the replica changes between primary to resolving, right? Primary to resolving is because there is a failover. I can see when the failover when the failure happened, and I know if this was something manually done or automatically done. And what I was talking about before is if you're going to choose columns, now we have UTC, so you can go and add the UTC timestamp, right? And then you can order based on the UTC timestamp. So if you have replicas across different geographic regions, you can correlate the logs between all of those. Okay. Talk about SQL clusters. So we have introduced support for Windows cluster chair volumes. Anybody familiar with Windows cluster chair volumes, CSVs? Most of you? Okay, good. So a cluster chair volume is a chair disk that is accessible to all the nodes in the cluster, right? So there is some well-defined naming scheme that you can use to refer to those volumes across all the machines in the cluster, right? They access it through SSMB, so they use the SSMB protocol, right? And you can have many of these CSVs in the same physical drive, right? So if you have one physical drive, you can create multiple CSVs there. Now, in SQL 2014, we have started supporting cluster chair volumes for SQL clusters. Why is this important to you? So the first thing is, this is going to improve your SAN utilization. So today, as you know, you have to bind some physical drives to your SQL Server instance in case of a SQL clusters, because if the SQL cluster goes down and there is a failover, you need to unbind those drives and then bind them to the new primary, right? The new machine that hosts the primary. So there is a limitation on the number of drives that you have. So the letters of the alphabet, minus probably if you have some CD-ROM drive or the OS drive, you have less drives. So the way that some of our customers have worked around this is through mount points, and that works. That works to some extent. It's just that there is additional management that you have to do to manage the mount points. A couple of very powerful things that you get with cluster chair volumes. The first one is increased I/O resiliency. So if your SQL Server, your SQL cluster is trying to write to your storage, like your SAN, for example, and for some reason the connectivity between the cluster node that owns the primary and the SAN fails, then the cluster chair volume will itself map that read or write across a different network path from a different cluster node in the system. And all of this becomes hidden from the SQL Server perspective. So this basically, you know, provides higher resiliency to failures to your storage from the cluster perspective. So very powerful mechanism. The other thing is increases failover resiliency. So as I mentioned today, you need to unmount and mount these drives in case of a failover. With cluster chair volumes, you don't need to do this. All you need to do is have access to the cluster chair volumes over SSMB. So if one of the servers goes down and then you fail over to the other one, that server will automatically be able to read from the cluster chair volumes, right? All it needs is the network connection to the storage. So because drives don't need to be unmounted and mounted, you reduce the possibility of failures during the failover process. So if you were to set it up today, this is how this would look like. So on the top, you have a Windows cluster, right? And then you can see all the disks, right? So similar to today, these are the disks that you have in the cluster. The only difference is that now this can be CSVs on top of the same physical storage. And then when you install SQL Cluster and you have to specify the shared disk that you will use for SQL Cluster, you can refer to the CSVs that you define in Windows Cluster. Right? So let me show you the demo, how this works in a running system. All right, so you're familiar, this is Windows Cluster. This is Windows Server 2012 R2, right? I have a cluster here, right? Here is the name of the cluster, right? You have the name of the cluster. You have the current owner of the cluster. This is using disk majority for you who are familiar with cluster quorum settings. So it's using a cluster disk as the disk witness, right? And then the role, before this was called services, the role that this is protecting is SQL Server, right? So this is a SQL Server cluster. SQL Server is running. Currently, the primary for the SQL cluster is N1. This is a machine. Now, if we look here into the properties of the cluster, you'll see this is the access name, right? This is how my clients can connect to the primary of the SQL cluster. And this has an IP associated with it. And you can see that the name is online. There are the resources that are depending on that cluster. We have the SQL Server engine, and then we have the SQL Server agent service. Right? And then if we look into storage and we look into the disk, we have four disks. The first one is the witness disk that we use for quorum, right? Just for quorum in the cluster. And the other three disks are cluster chair volumes that I have created. Right? You can see that all of these cluster chair volumes are actually in the same physical drive, right? So inside of C, I have the well-known name, cluster storage, right? This is the well-known name that the cluster knows to find the cluster chair volumes. And then I have three volumes, volume 3, 1, and 2, all of those part of the same physical drive, right? Now, if I go to SQL Server, right, I connected Management Studio to the name of the cluster, right? So irrespective of who owns the primary, Management Studio will connect to it. And I have a database here. And the first thing is, let's look at the database files, right? So if I run this query from master file, just to look at the physical files for all of the databases in the SQL instance, I can see that all of these, you know, you have the different system databases as well as the user database. I have the names of the files. And you can see the physical names when they are stored. So you can see that I'm using one of the volumes, right, that is cluster chair volume, right? So you can start using all of those cluster chair volumes that are part of the same physical drive to store your data and log files. We added this new DMB, IO cluster valid path names. So this gives you information about all the cluster chair volumes that your SQL cluster is using. So I see that I have three CSVs, right, that are available to SQL. I can see who the owner of those CSVs is. Right? Similar to the SQL cluster itself, these cluster chair volumes have an owner. If for some reason the owner is not available, the cluster chair volume itself will become available to a different owner. Right? And then just indication that this is a cluster chair volume. So at this point in time, I can go into my SQL cluster, right, and I can do a failover from the Windows cluster side and then say, I want to move my SQL cluster. I want to move it from N1 to N2. This will take some time. At some point, this will come back online on the new node, and then Management Studio will continue connecting to the new primary. Right? So this is running again. And it will take a little bit of time, but Management Studio will connect to that name. Let's see. Okay. I may have to reconnect after the failover. Any questions so far? Cluster chair volumes, make sense? This probably take a little bit of time here. So let me go back to the presentation where I have 5 minutes. There are a couple of things that I wanted to discuss. So SQL Server high availability at this point is more than just SQL. So we're not anymore in those times where, you know, database mirroring will try to solve every potential problem. We have taken a dependency in Windows Server, right, for some of the high availability functionality that we do in Always On, specifically on the Windows cluster side. So every time that there are enhancements on Windows cluster, we benefit as part of that. Here are some of the enhancements that I want to mention, right? Starting in Windows Server 2012, we have two important enhancements. The first one is increased network resiliency. So Windows cluster has improved the mechanisms to handle network failures between the cluster nodes. So if today, for example, you're using Windows Server 2008 or 2, for example, and you see the continuous cluster node evictions, or you see the cluster losing quorum, for example, especially in large geographic distributed areas, you should look into Windows Server 2012 or Windows Server 2012 R2 because of the network resiliency enhancements that they have done. Dynamic quorum, this is a very cool feature. If you configure your cluster with dynamic quorum, it's just an option on, in the cluster that you can specify, every time that a node becomes unavailable, like if you lose connectivity to one node in the cluster, Windows cluster will detect that and will remove the boot for the quorum out of that node, so that for the cluster, only the remaining nodes are considered, right? So what this allows you to do is support sequential failures of nodes, right, while still having a small subset of nodes that are continue running, right? So the worst case scenario is you have 3 nodes in the cluster. One goes down, the next one goes down, and at that point, with dynamic quorum, the remaining node, which will be hosting your primary replica, will continue running, even if 2 out of 3 nodes are down, right? So very powerful capability. Network names without Active Directory. So anybody running into issues with Active Directory? Only me. All right. So today, when you try to create some names for the cluster, for example, the cluster network name or the listeners for availability groups, Windows Cluster by default tries to write those into Active Directory. So if those names already exist, or if you don't have the right permissions, and in most companies, very few people have the right permissions to write objects into Active Directory, this will fail. So Windows Cluster has removed this requirement so that now you can create listeners, for example, without Active Directory, and this will go and register directly in DNS. Right? So this removes a lot of the issues with security and name collisions. So at this point, we have a couple of minutes left. Thank you a lot for coming. Do you have any questions before we close? Yes. Okay. All right, so the question is, are we going to support some of this functionality in the standard? I cannot officially, you know, commit to that. We're working into that. It's something that is likely to happen, but officially I cannot say anything more than that. Any other questions? Yes. Yes, the question is, can a primary replica be part of a merge-to-merge replication? Peer-to-peer. Yes, the answer is yes, it can. So thank you very much for attending. I'll be still here in case you have any other questions.